There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
After all, these are a couple of high-stepping turkeys, and you know what to say about a high-stepper. No step too high for a high-stepper.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the beer we got? I mean, the beer we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
All right, here we go. FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. Glad to have you along. Live local talk over the next couple of hours. But we will go to the press briefing at the White House as soon as that goes live. It's supposed to be happening any minute now. And there's lots to talk about here. And we'll get as much of this laid out before the press briefing as we can with Manafort, the accusation holding secret talks with Julian Assange at the Ecuadorian embassy. That'll be part of this discussion. But also, most interestingly, will be the decorum, lack thereof, or how that will work as you have the new rules in effect. Remember, Post Acosta rules in effect for White House press briefings. So you'll have the initial portion where you'll have Sarah Sanders come out, do the press briefing. Then the questions will happen. How will that work? Will the members of the media fall in line with the new? And I don't know all the... I try to get a full layout of all the new rules for the press briefings. I don't have all those, but they have put some into effect here. And how the White House would like it to go. We'll see what the members of the media do if they follow the rules here on the new rules for the briefings. But this is going to happen any second. The story right now, as it stands, because I think these things change as people grab any piece of information and say, well, this is a sure thing, let's run with it. Here's the latest being reported that President Trump said, story from The Guardian, UK, and President Trump's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, held secret talks with Julian Assange inside the Ecuadorian embassy in London and visited around the time that he joined Trump's campaign. Sources said Manafort went to see Assange in 2013 and 2015 and in spring of 2016, during the period when he was made a key figure in Trump's push for the White House. So they point out that 2013, I don't know how that should really count. Wouldn't do anything with the campaign there, but it's unclear why Manafort would wanted to see Assange and what was discussed. But the last apparent meeting is likely to come under scrutiny and could interest Robert Mueller, the special prosecutor. Blah, 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 blah. All right. A well-placed source had told The Guardian that Manafort went to see Assange in March of 2016. Months later, WikiLeaks released a stash of Democratic emails stolen by Russian intelligence officers. Manafort denies involvement in the hack and says the claim is 100% false. His lawyers declined to answer The Guardian's questions about the visits. I guess Manafort can't answer those questions because Manafort is in jail. All right, so he's not available for that. In a series of tweets, WikiLeaks said Assange and Manafort had not met. So WikiLeaks that has, I mean, like them or not, I mean, there's a lot of reason not to like them, but they've been pretty accurate. WikiLeaks has said that Assange and Manafort did not meet. Assange is describing the story as a hoax. Remember, Assange is still there in the embassy, the Ecuadorian embassy there in London. Although I think they're thinking about kicking him out or making him run for it or something. Manafort was jailed this year and thought to have become a star cooperator in the Mueller inquiry. But yesterday, Mueller said Manafort had repeatedly lied to the FBI despite agreeing to cooperate 2 months ago in the plea deal. According to a court document, Manafort had committed, quote, crimes and lies on a variety of subject matters, end quote. His defense team says they believe he has told Mueller, believes what he has told Mueller to be truthful, and he has not violated his deal. Manafort's first visit to the embassy took place a year after Assange sought asylum, according to sources. So the unnamed sources are saying that these meetings happened in 2013, 2015, 2016. Julian Assange himself says they did not happen. All right, we're going to go to the presser here in a second. Looks like there's some movement there in the briefing room. As soon as Sarah Sanders goes, we'll go live to that. It goes on to say a separate internal document written by Ecuador's CENIEN intelligence agency and seen by The Guardian lists Paul Manafort as one of several well-known guests at the embassy, and it also mentions Russians. According to sources, Manafort returned to the embassy in 2015. He paid another visit in spring of 2016, turning up alone around the time Trump named him as the convention manager. I guess that's a British term for campaign. The visit is tentatively dated to March. Manafort's 2016 visit to Assange lasted for 40 minutes, according to a source, adding that the American, who was casually dressed when he exited the embassy, wearing sandy-colored chinos, a cardigan, and a light-colored shirt. I mean, I like the detail there, but I guess good look for Manafort. They said visitors normally register with embassy security guards and show their passports. Sources in Ecuador, however, say Manafort was not logged. Embassy staff were aware only later of the potential significance of Manafort's visit and his political role with President or then-candidate Trump. The revelation could shed new light on the sequence of events in the run-up to summer of 2016 when WikiLeaks published tens of thousands of emails hacked by the GRU, Russian military intelligence agency. Hillary Clinton has said that hack contributed to her defeat. Oh, Hillary, that's part of a lot of things it did. The previously unreported Manafort-Assange connection is likely to be of interest to Mueller, who's been investigating possible contacts between WikiLeaks and associates of Trump, including political lobbyists, here we go, Roger Stone and Donald Trump Jr. All right, so what they're laying out, and they go into more detail here, but once again, this is going to be, I wish we could get to the end of one of these and find out who is not telling the truth. You've got these unnamed sources here in the Guardian UK story saying, in fact, not just once, but multiple times, that Manafort's there at the Ecuadorian embassy. Do they not have, can we see, they not get the Ring doorbell? Do they not, I can get the Ring doorbell. You've got the Ring doorbell. Is there not a Ring doorbell at the Ecuadorian embassy? Can we not go back and see if Manafort wearing his pastel-colored shirt and his chinos and his topsiders or whatever the heck they had him in, was there checking in? I mean, you have they're denying that he was there, and then these unnamed sources said not only was he there once, he was there three times. I mean, it seems like this is not one that gets lost in the gray or the pastel grays. Either he would. I mean, you don't forget you went to the Ecuadorian embassy, do you? You know, I mean, that's not something like, and now you said that I did travel across the Atlantic and go to the Ecuadorian embassy. That's not something you would forget. So, I mean, somebody is straight up lying. Now, is this, 2013, I would argue, what does that really have to do with linking this to then-candidate Trump? 2015, 2016 would be of interest. And we'll see. But Julian Assange and company there at WikiLeaks are saying, nah, this didn't happen. Now, you would say, why do you trust WikiLeaks? I don't trust WikiLeaks for anything other than the fact that they've been generally, they would score more accurate than many government agencies out there, right? Which is not saying much. But WikiLeaks has a better track record of saying something is a thing and then it turning out to be a thing. Now, it may be some kind of deal. If you want to play conspiracy theorist, I'll do it for you. You say, it's a deal, and Assange is going to say what he needs to say to avoid, once he gets kicked out of the Ecuadorian embassy in London, from being prosecuted by the Brits or us or some other nation out there. I don't know. That's the situation as it stands. Going into this press conference, it should be starting any time here, and the side story of the presser will be the fact that the new rules supposedly are in effect here, and we'll see if the reporters stick with it or not. As soon as they go live there, we'll take you to that press conference right here on FM Talk 106.5. 12:15, we'll check the news and we'll be right back.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Yeah, 12:20, FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. We will go to that presser as soon as you get a green light there, it'll be interesting. A couple things, of course, the questions about this Manafort stuff, and then the kind of the overriding, how will the reporters act with the new rules set up at the White House? As soon as that goes live, we will do that as well. And a couple things. Yeah, I saw the I saw the story from down. It was funny because yesterday, right, we had DJ Landrum on from Landco Forestry. If you missed that, that was in the second hour of the show. And we're talking about control burns and just kind of looking at what could be done out in California in the aftermath of another tragic fire season. Deadly. 83 dead, 100 still missing out there. What could be done out there with land management? And we talked about control burns and all that, prescribed burns and stuff that we do here at home in the Southeast. Could those things be done out West? And interestingly enough, we were talking about what's done here in Alabama, not just at a local level, you know, like a private properties level, but what's being done as a state. And I think they're doing that right now, if I am correct. Let's see if I got the link here for it. I think they're running a control burn today down in South Baldwin. Somebody was posting up pictures here of that of the smoke coming up, and I think that's what it is. I think they were doing that. Dalton, maybe you can grab that story. I thought I had it in here in my stack, but some reason it's gone. But I think they are doing that. If you see smoke down in South Baldwin, that's probably what's going on. Yeah, and Tim, thank you for the pictures. Sent me some pictures as well that they're doing one of those. I think that is Gulf State Park as part of the process of, you know, run those fires through. It's kind of early in the season to be doing that, but, you know, maybe it's prescribed that way. What'd you find, man?
You're correct. Gulf State Park controlled burn, and News 5 had live video of it earlier if you want to watch a fire burn.
You know, can I take a second? And I love my friends in television, friends at all the local TV stations, but let me say this. Y'all got it so easy. You can run to the video of a fire, be it control burn, apartment fire, wreck scene, or whatever, and you can just leave the camera on, and you'll have a whole bunch of people migrate onto your Facebook page to watch just paint dry sometimes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's very exciting. Sometimes it's super compelling video. I'm with you. And sometimes it's paint drying and go, oh, another dusting off your jeans, another hard day at work. You know, come on.
Well, the most famous live video stream ever, as far as I'm concerned, the April the giraffe giving birth. You wouldn't want to mix those two videos.
No.
The control burn and April the giraffe.
Possibly not.
I wonder if it was kind of like, you know, on TVs you can have the fireplace burning in your TV instead of actually having a fireplace.
Right.
I wonder if it kind of looked
like that. They do that, and then they get like all these, you know, all this traffic on their social media sites. Well, y'all just set up a camera. I'll go set up a, you know, a little like an IP camera out here at I-65 and Airport by our studios, and maybe we'll just feed that.
And the comments are great. Yeah. Checking in, Tillman's Corner.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm from Idaho. Oh wow, how'd you get here?
I'm checking in to watch nothing happen. I think something might happen, so I'm going to sit around here and watch this until... Hey, as we're talking about fire, too, we'll talk about this more on the show this week, but congratulations, Mobile Fire Rescue. Y'all are number one. Got an ISO 1 rating. This announcement today during a presentation at the Crichton Fire Station. Every fire department in the nation is rated between 1 and 10 on this ISO scale. 1 is the best. 10 is not the best.
Yeah.
10 is needs improvement. Okay. Only 320 fire departments out of 44,000 in the country have an ISO 1 rating. In previous years, Mobile Fire Rescue had an ISO 3 rating. Well, it came out today. ISO 1, Fire Chief Mark Seely said, I want to thank we talked about this, and also the mayor was talking about thanking Mark Seely and the 500 members of Mobile Fire Rescue. Yeah, let's talk about all those folks that are making this happen. Thanks to y'all. Mayor went on to say this is a result of a strong collaboration amongst multiple city departments and the Mobile Area Water and Sewer System, getting the water to the firefighters, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, Maws,
very
good job.
Important.
Good job. This top insurance rating supports our ever-growing economy. Most importantly, it reassures our citizens that they are receiving the best care. This is a huge step towards becoming the safest city in America. When the mayor mentioned the insurance part of it, the key is here, and I want to get into this later in the week, and hopefully we'll have Chief Seely on the show with us this week, is talking about what that means for insurance rates. The way I've been told, and somebody correct me if I'm wrong, but this means our insurance rates come down.
That's good news.
Your homeowners insurance rates come down because you have a ISO 1 rating. That is if you're in the service area of Mobile Fire Department. Goes on here to say, to achieve this top rating, Mobile Fire Rescue Department worked for over a year and a half to inspect 11,000 businesses, 14,000 fire hydrants, and 90 schools, ensuring the safety of Mobile's homes, workforce, and school children. Goes on here, it says, today's announcement is proof to others of what I've known for nearly 28 years, that Mobile Fire Rescue Department is among the best in the nation, said Chief Seeley. We could not have done it without every single member of Mobile Fire Rescue Department buying into our vision. To reach the ISO 1 rating, they poured hundreds of hours of work into this goal while still maintaining their normal responsibilities. No task was too large or too small. So there we go, ISO 1. You're number one. Thank you.
And what an exclusive club. You said of 44,000 departments, only 320. That's impressive. That is really impressive.
Yeah, it's good. I mean, it's a nice thing to say, job well done, Mobile Fire. But at the same time, it should mean, if I understand this correctly, discounting to our homeowners insurance if you're in the service area of Mobile Fire Rescue. I'm sure there'll be more discussion of that, but that is kind of the why you should. Number one, of course, you should be excited about it because that means faster response, all these things. You have the fire department working the best it can in our community. That's great. And the other part of it is we all like to save some money on our insurance, so hopefully that shows up here soon in our premiums.
And also some breaking news over the last hour. I know a lot of parents probably care about this show, and I'd say about half of millennials, the show got big right after I was a kid, but mm-hmm. SpongeBob SquarePants, the creator of that show, passed away at the age of 57. Yeah, he had ALS, and I guess he just revealed last March that he had ALS, and it worked quickly because he passed away. I believe he passed away today or yesterday. Nickelodeon released a statement today. Steven Hillenburg is his name, and I guess he created SpongeBob SquarePants, all of the characters in that show. He did not do the SpongeBob voice, which was my first question, whether he was the voice behind SpongeBob, but he was the creator of SpongeBob and passed away at the age of 57 of ALS.
Yeah, there's one of those shows that he'll be the easy thing to sit there and go, that show has driven me crazy over the years with my children watching it. And that would be fair, and I'm sure there's parents nodding along with me. But my gosh, the children got something from that show. They really liked it. Mm-hmm. I mean, was it crass? And it was crass, but it was not, I don't think, compared to where everything else is in today's world, I don't think it was completely over the top. Do you?
No, it's a lot like the Looney Tunes, where kids can watch it, and of course kids get something out of it because it's animated film. Yes. And it's SpongeBob,
that's
of course,
right.
But the parents were able to watch that too, and it kind of had some adult elements. And I guess the first episode, May of 1999, so I would have been
that far back.
I would have been 7 going on 8. Somehow I missed the boat of SpongeBob when I was a kid, but I know a lot of people around my age grew up on SpongeBob, and they still make new episodes, I believe.
So he's passed on, the guy that created, I guess he created, were all those characters there? Was Squidward and
he made
Mr. Krabs?
All the main all this characters. Stuff. Patrick.
Yeah, Patrick.
For some reason, that came up on Mobile Mornings earlier mm-hmm. this week. Patrick from SpongeBob SquarePants. But
what was the Plankton guy? Was it Plankton?
Squidward? Was
that
his
Plankton,
name?
There was a little, like their arch nemesis, bad guy, was a little Plankton, had a Napoleonic complex of some sort because he was, you know, Plankton. I think his name was Plankton.
Yeah. If you, there's a great video on YouTube called 10 Hours of SpongeBob's Laugh. I recommend you don't let your kid know about that video if you don't want to be annoyed to the high heavens.
So he's, and the name again?
Steven Hillenburg, 57, ALS, man.
It
gets
stuff.
A lot of really good people. It's an awful, awful disease.
Yeah, but what a legacy guy's got, even though, you know, you may say that show has driven me crazy for years, but obviously very successful. And part that show now, one of those things you can say that is part of the American experience. That is part of, you know, for people in the last, I would say my, you know, my age group because of our children and maybe older, but from there on, that's something that could show up on Jeopardy or something, a question like that or an answer that you would know. I mean, that's part of it's part of pop culture.
Yeah, I mean, it has its own world down in Orlando, right? There's, I think, a SpongeBob, a huge section of Universal Studios completely devoted to SpongeBob. I'd put it right there with maybe not quite to Looney Tunes and Mickey Mouse yet and all of those characters.
Mickey Mouse, but I would,
it's going on 20 years now episodes.
No, I would say to, you know, children over the last, I'd say 20 and under, SpongeBob SquarePants is a lot more ubiquitous than any Looney Tunes.
Yeah, probably so.
I mean, how many of them would identify SpongeBob before Porky Pig?
Oh, none of them. I don't know if any kids know of Porky Pig.
Right. They'd know SpongeBob and not Porky Pig. So there you go. Well, that's sad news.
Yeah.
Coming back, we will talk a little more about this fire rating, and we'll also get into, hopefully, this presser that was supposed to start a while ago in Washington. Coming up right here on Midday Mobile.
I can't hear you.
Aye, aye, Captain.
Oh, who lives in a pineapple under the sea?
SpongeBob SquarePants.
Absorbent and yellow and porous is he. Nonsense be something you wish.
SpongeBob SquarePants.
Then drop on the deck and flop like a fish.
SpongeBob SquarePants.
Ready?
SpongeBob SquarePants.
SpongeBob SquarePants. SpongeBob SquarePants.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, that presser started. Let's go right to it.
...with other world leaders and advance a global economic system that is based on fair economic competition and free, fair, and reciprocal trade. While at the G20, the president and the delegation will interact with many leaders, including bilateral meetings with the president of Argentina, the president of Russia, prime minister of Japan, and the chancellor of Germany, and a working dinner with the president of China. To speak more about the G20 and what the president intends to accomplish, I'd like to welcome to the podium director of National Economic Council, Larry Kudlow, and following him, National Security Advisor, Ambassador John Bolton. After the remarks, both will be available to take your questions on the G20 and other foreign policy news of the day, and then I'll be back up to take other questions on news of the day.
Thank you. Thank you, Sarah. Thanks, everybody. Let me just walk through some quick themes, and then I want to mention some things the president talked to us just a little while ago. As Sarah said, G20, funny, it's not actually the G20 when we count it up properly, as Ambassador Bolton points out. It's much more than the G20. Now, in terms of the U.S. positions, we're going to use this as an opportunity to talk about our measures of tax cuts and deregulations and reskilling and job training and so forth that have generated significant economic growth and prosperity. That includes women's economic empowerment. As Sarah mentioned, free, fair, and reciprocal trade and trade reform. There'll be discussions of infrastructure, finance, and also the U.S. emergence as the dominant energy power in the world today, actually. In terms of the much-discussed meeting, it's going to be a dinner meeting. Between President Trump and President Xi and representatives from both sides. It'll be bilateral. I want to just mention what President told us a short while ago, and that is, in his view, there's a good possibility that a deal can be made, and that he is open to that. He is open to that. But having said that, some caveats, as always. Certain conditions have to be met with respect to fairness and reciprocity, as we've said many times. For example, issues of intellectual property theft must be solved. Forced technology transfers must be solved. Significant tariffs and non-tariff barriers must be solved. Issues of ownership have to be solved. The president will probably reiterate his view. We want a world, ideally, of zero tariffs, zero non-tariff barriers, and zero subsidies. Now, whether they can get through all that remains to be seen, but that's the president's point of view, as I said just a little while ago. U.S. is coming to the summit in very good shape. Our economy is quite strong. It's growing at 3% over the past year. Second quarter was 4.2, third quarter was 3.5, perhaps be revised upwards. We have a very strong holiday season, so-called Black Friday, very strong. We've had tremendous investments, business investments, energy investments. oil prices and gasoline prices coming down. That helps consumers, of course. We're in very good shape. China, not so good. I'm not here to critique or second-guess the Chinese economy, but most observers believe China to be in a slump, whereas the United States is in a very strong, solid position going into this summit. However, again, to repeat, the president said there is a good possibility that we can make a deal, and he is open to it. But on the other hand, if these conditions I mentioned a few moments ago are not met, not dealt with, you know, the president has said, look, he's perfectly happy to stand on his tariff policies, which 10% last $200 billion, scheduled to go to 25%. That's not a certainty, but that's the schedule. And he has said as recently as yesterday, the day before, if need be, if things don't work out in this U.S.-China summit meeting, he will invoke another $267 some odd billion in tariffs. That may not be the first choice. I'm just saying that is his view. If we can't get something done, and things have been moving very slowly between the two countries, until the president himself called President Xi and said, let's restart, let's try to get things going again. And then since then, he's made positive comments about that. So we will see. As I said, the key U.S. goal is around growth and prosperity. And you know, our economy is in good shape. Theirs is not. I'll just leave it right there. John, do you want to add stuff to that? Do you want me to take some questions? You sure? Okay, good. Let me take some questions and try to help out on this. Yes?
Mr. Pillow, I'd like you to address some concerns recently from representatives of Italy and France and Germany. You say that we're actually backing away from the national stage, and they fear that Russia will be the dominant economic force in Europe and the Middle East in the coming years. Could you address those concerns, A, and B, can you tell us a little bit, if you can, about the layoffs at GM?
Well, I'll talk to you about GM layoffs. Regarding the Russian story, I'm going to leave that to my longtime friend and colleague, John Bolton. I met with Mary Barra yesterday, and we had a lengthy conversation about the layoffs, the cause of the layoffs. It's a great disappointment, obviously. The president indicated his own disappointment. He believes, as frankly the Prime Minister of Canada, Trudeau, believes, that the USMCA deal was a great help to the automobile industry and to auto workers. And by the way, they made those statements separately. And yet, GM comes in right after the deal. By the way, that deal will be signed in Argentina with the U.S. And Canadian representatives. So there's great disappointment there. There's disappointment that it seems like GM would rather build its electric cars in China rather than in the United States. We are going to be looking at certain subsidies regarding electric cars and others, whether they should apply or not. I can't say anything final about that, but we're looking into it. Again, that reflects the president's own disappointment regarding these actions. Ms. Barrett told me, on the other hand, I want to be completely fair here, it's her business, it may be possible to transfer workers to other plants in Texas and Michigan. I'm not an expert on General Motors. I'm not an analyst, auto analyst, but that's what she said. But obviously, there's a lot of disappointment, even anger. I've heard it, again, from Mr. Trudeau, from President Trump, from Democrats and Republicans.
Just to follow, do you think it's going to adversely affect our economy coming into the Christmas season and after?
No. I mean, look, I don't want anybody to get laid off. I want workers to do very well. I want worker wages to do well, and they are. I mean, that's one of the great things. You know, there's a certain amount of pessimism that I'm reading about. Maybe it has to do with a mild stock market correction. Let's not forget, a couple weeks ago, just on this very point, we had 250,000 new jobs, which was a blockbuster number. Nobody really expected it. With a 3.1% yearly gain in wages and a 3.7% unemployment rate, those are very spiffy numbers by any benchmark in any metric. So again, holiday season layoffs from GM, brutal, all right? Very disappointing. Will it affect the overall economy? I don't think so. I do not think so. Yes.
Yeah, back to the question of the tariffs. If these talks with President Xi go nowhere, and we move forward with this escalation of the tariffs that you just described, which, correct me if I'm wrong, would be the biggest addition of tariffs that we've seen in your lifetime, what will the impact be on the U.S. economy? I mean, you as
that's
a
long, asking, that's a long period of time you mentioned my lifetime.
You've been a committed free trader for almost all of those years.
Yeah.
So what will be the impact on the U.S. economy if we see tariffs go up to the degree that you just described?
You know, we'll see what happens, okay? I don't want to presuppose anything. President's going to make up his mind after the meeting. But I will say this. Our economy is in very good shape right now. And when you multiply through whatever numbers you want to use, $250 billion or tack on another tranche, which may or may not happen, at a 10% tariff rate or more, it's really just a fraction of our economy. Okay? It's just a fraction of our economy. I'm not suggesting that there aren't winners and losers in that game. It's a complicated game. But on the other hand, I think we are in far better shape to weather this than the Chinese are. And I'll say one thing. I appreciate your characterization. I am a free trader. But you have to ask yourself, this is what President Trump has been talking about, is it free trade when there's clear evidence of unfair and WTO illegal trading practices by China for several decades? Is that fair? Is that free? Is it free when intellectual property theft occurs, or when Chinese ownership of American companies force transference of technology from American companies to the Chinese companies? Is that fair? Or high tariffs on agriculture and industrial supplies? Is that fair? So, President Trump is the first president in, I don't know, at least 20 years, and I'm including Democrats and Republicans, who not only has made this case, but continues to make this case forcefully and to take actions to defend American workers and our overall economy. Other presidents in both parties have raised the issue and then walked away from it. And President Trump obviously doesn't intend to. You know, this is under the heading, I think, for him of promises made, promises kept. It's something he's talked about for several years, and he now continues. If China will come to the table, or in this case, the dinner table, with some new ideas and some new attitudes and some new cooperation, as the president said, there's a good possibility they can make a deal. He's open to it. So nothing is written in cement or stone. But again, for a free trader, where's the free trade? And for several months now, since I've been here, President and I have talked about this. You know, we'd love to see a world of zero tariffs and zero non-tariff barriers and zero subsidies. We'd love to see that world. But unfortunately, we don't have that world, particularly with respect to China, but not only China. And so he's taking actions that he thinks will get us closer to that world. Let me go around. Yes, please.
Thanks. Just another GM question. When the president said yesterday they better damn well open a new plant there very quickly, was he just venting his frustration, or does he have some consequences in mind if they don't?
You know, I'm going to leave that to him. There, you may find additional announcements coming on that topic. Some more. Let me go on the back. Yes, ma'am.
I wanted to ask you about what Ambassador Shui Tiankai said recently to the Wall Street Journal. Ambassador Shui Tiankai, the Chinese ambassador to the United States, his thought was that there would be a real risk to global to the global markets if there wasn't a deal, that they could become fragmented as well. How big are the stakes if you can't reach a deal?
Look, the ambassador makes a point. Now, if he would do his part, or his government would do their part, then we can all make a much better point. That's what President Trump is saying. I mean, I'll read you the quote again. There's a good possibility we can make a deal, and he's open to it. But certain conditions you know, have to be met. Certain things have to be changed. And the president, again, in the spirit of promises made, promises kept, is going to defend, you know, the interests of American workers and ranchers and small businesses and the economy writ large. Let me just add one other point to this. The rest of the world agrees with us. I mean, we signed at the UN, for example, a trilateral agreement with the EU, the United States, and Japan. Worth looking at that document, which outlines, you know, what they call non-market abuses. Read China. Just recently, before the Shanghai conference, where President Xi was to give an important speech, I'm not sure there was much new there, but in any case, just before that conference, with no prodding from the USA, the ambassadors, the French and German ambassadors to China, the French and German ambassadors to China wrote a very tough piece going after, again, non-market, unfair, non-reciprocal trading practices. There is broad-based support for the American position here, which is China should change its practices and come into the community of responsible trading nations. They can do that, right? They're a major economy right now. It's not like they were 25 or 30 years ago. We would welcome it. The president has said he's happy to make a deal, but they have to take certain actions and give certain assurances. So, you know.
Do you think you'll spend the G20 getting that support around your position from other countries at the G20?
Well, I'm sure we will. I'm sure we will. We have in many other forms. Just a couple more. I want Ambassador. Yes, please.
Thank you. Yes, he was talking to me. Tariffs are, in effect, a tax on imported products that are paid for by the consumer. So does the president realize that these escalated tariffs are going to be paid for by the American citizens?
Well, look, he realizes the ramifications. As I said earlier, given the strength of our economy, given the size of our economy, we are in position to deal with this and handle this very well. That's the key point. And I'm not so sure about China, but I'll leave that to China experts and so forth and so on. The benefits, let me just look at the other side of the ledger. It's very important. The benefits of true free trade globally will be enormous. Now, if we go back to the idea of zero tariffs and zero non-tariff barriers and zero subsidies. If China plays by the rules, even the WTO rules and all that needs reforming in our judgment, but they're violating those rules. If we do have a free trading system, or we move in the direction of a free trading system, a true free trading system, we will benefit enormously. Frankly, we will benefit. They will benefit, and the rest of the world will benefit. Now, free trade throws off enormous benefits when it's done properly and consistently and in a reciprocal manner. That's a key point the president emphasized. He's absolutely right. So, you know, I think of it as possibly a long rainbow here. At the end of that rainbow is a pot of gold. You open up that pot and you have prosperity for the rest of the world, but you got to get through that long rainbow. We're not there yet. We can get there. The president is reaching out, but we'll see how that works.
Earlier you mentioned low oil and gas prices as evidence that the president's economic policy is working. You mentioned the U.S. becoming the global dominant energy player. But merely days ago, the president said that it was necessary to let Saudi Arabia and its crown prince get away with ordering the murder of a Washington Post journalist because Saudi Arabia ensures low gas prices. Now, which one is it, sir?
I'm going to let Ambassador Bolton handle that question. I'm trying so hard to swim in my own lane, and I think John will help out with that whole discussion.
He's sitting there too calmly
and quietly, so I want to get him up here. We've known each other a very long time. You're on, John.
Just right under the bus.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. I don't really have much to add. Sarah gave you the list of bilaterals. Let me just update it a little bit because we're trying to fill every minute of the president's schedule. She said he's going to meet with President Macri, the host government of Argentina. He'll meet with President Moon of South Korea. He'll meet with President Erdogan of Turkey, Prime Minister Abe of Japan. That will transform at some point during that meeting into a trilateral meeting with the Prime Minister of India, Narendra Modi. And then, as Sarah said, the president will meet with President Putin and have a working dinner with President Xi.
Thank you, sir. Does the president have any plans in the works to meet with the Saudi crown prince while he's there?
No. Look, the bilateral schedule is full to overflowing at this point, and so that those are the ones I've listed that he'll be meeting with. Yes, ma'am.
Hello.
Mr.
Yes. I have a question about the border tensions right now with the U.S. and Mexico. U.S. Launched tear gas canisters into Mexican soil, and I'm wondering if you've gotten, if Mexico was given the go-ahead before that happened, and what is the U.S. doing to mitigate any tensions right now with the incoming López Obrador administration?
Yeah, I don't think that's really a subject of the G20, but I can say that Secretary of State Pompeo, who will be attending the G20 and therefore will not be accompanying Vice President Pence to the inauguration on Saturday the 1st, Secretary Pompeo will fly overnight from Argentina to Mexico and will meet with the new foreign minister of Mexico on Sunday the 2nd. And they'll have a full conversation about all the issues in connection with the border.
Yeah. What do you expect to be on the agenda for the president's meeting with Putin?
Well, I think all of the issues that we have on security issues, on arms control issues, on regional issues, including the Middle East, I think it'll be a full agenda. I think it'll be a continuation of their discussion in Helsinki.
Thank you so much, Ambassador. Two questions about Brazil, since you are heading there on Thursday to meet with the new incoming president from Brazil, Jair Bolsonaro. One on trade, that I know is one of the priorities. For the past few years, Brazil had a trade surplus with Brazil.
Just
last year, $27 billion alone. And besides of that, President Trump complained about the Brazilian protectionism, say Brazil is one of the toughest on trade access. What should we expect related to trade relationship with Brazil, with the new Brazilian government? Should we expect more cooperation or more tariffs like those on steel and aluminum? And another one on Venezuela that I know is another priority of the meeting. What kind of cooperation are you expecting with the new Brazilian government? Are you guys going to discuss sanctions?
Yeah. Well, the meeting with President-elect Bolsonaro came as a result of President Trump's call on election night in Brazil to congratulate President-elect Bolsonaro. They had a really outstanding phone call, I think, developed a personal relationship even remotely. President Trump was the first foreign leader to call President-elect Bolsonaro. So following up on this, we thought it would be useful and certainly very helpful to the United States to hear from the President-elect what his priorities are, what he's looking for in the relationship. From the perspective of the United States, we see this as a historic opportunity for Brazil and the United States to work together in a whole host of areas, economics, security.
All right. We will get back to that. If something changes in the presser, right now it's been fairly tame. So we'll come back next hour and be joined by Cameron Smith right here on Midday Mobile.